Well, can you imagine if they're listening to your radio transmission right now saying, if he only knew what we knew?
Yeah, I agree. These poor guys, they think they know. Boy, I love well, they're going to find out. You know, you do any study of any particular field, you soon discover the amount of information you don't know is considerably greater than the amount you know. You're never going to know it all. The Leonardo da Vinci, a guy who was sort of a smart guy in every field, you can't have that anymore. There's too much specialization going on. So, if you think they did listen in on it, sir, what do you think they would believe, Zayed?
I'm not sure. I guess I get a kick out of you running the tech night each week.
Yeah, this crazy guy thinks he knows something. Well, what you're listening to is amateur radio attempting to help each other. Hams are very, as I started saying, at 7 o'clock I made the mistake of opening the tech net. I thought it was 8 o'clock. And I said hams are very good at helping each other when it comes to helping humanity, when it comes to things like earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, volcanic eruptions, any of these natural disasters. The hams come along and help with the emergency communication. Well, the hams also help each other, and the TechNet is a gathering of people who share with other little pieces of information they find out, how to make better transmitters, receivers, feed lines, and so on. Let's see if Mel is still there. K2KEY, K2LIW.
I just thought somebody else wanted to make comments, but if I heard somebody, then I guess you picked them up, Dick, over.
Sure did. I did say, as I passed it over to you, do any of the emails you get ask any questions on the subject of extraterrestrial life as well as extraterrestrial intelligence? And I also said that I think you and I have a date next Saturday night. And you might want to mention anyone who wants to visit the Ryan, I think it's called the Ryan Visitor Center at Floyd Bennett Field in Brooklyn. That's where the Kings County Radio Club is going to have a significant radio setup that they do almost every year for a field day. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Yes, I was going to elaborate on that in a short time. But I guess, okay, we can pick that up now on our usual discussion here of emails and all. And first, let me put in the plug, the sponsorship here for the Kings County Radio Club. Yes, we are going to have our field day at the Ryan Visitor Center. That's at Floyd Bennett Field. That's right off Flatbush Avenue near the Marine Parkway Bridge. To get there is very simple. Right down Flatbush Avenue, just before you get to the bridge, there's a traffic light. Make a left turn, and you'll see a big runway as you go into the Floyd Bennett, see the big wide runway there. Go down that runway, well, you see the building, the main building there. When you get opposite that main building, you'll see another road leads right up to the building. And plenty of parking, plenty of, as they say, free parking, the empty set. And so, everybody's welcome. Come and visit. All right, let me let it drop.
Mel, isn't that building with a great big observation deck on the top that used to be the control tower for all of Floyd Bennett Field? Go ahead.
It's the old control tower. I guess it was the most popular airport in New York, believe it or not, in the 1920s. It was the first airport, first New York City airport. What happened, of course, is along came the Second World War, and it was annexed by the government. They trained the Navy pilots there. And so the building was put up and reinforced like a fortress. And the control tower up there was super reinforced. I guess they had to have that tower literally survive an airplane, directed by an airplane. If you were the person that hit it, you lost your life. Well, that's too bad, but the tower had to survive, Dick, over.
Well, I think the top of the tower is, what, approximately 3 or 4 floors above the Tarmac, go ahead.
That's an ice resort, a nice, beautiful site up there. We go up there in, last year, and if you remember that, we were playing around with laser lights, and just looking at the beautiful view, the 360-degree view from up there, and it's up, it's 4 floors up, so, and it's all flatlands out there. In fact, that's what the name of the area is, basically, flatlands. And it's quite a view, and usually we have tours up there, not much of the left of the old equipment, but we have pictures of exactly how the tower performed during its heydays. And quite an interesting place to come to, so all is welcome. I hope you can surely make it, Dick, over.
Yeah, I definitely intend to. Last year when I was there during field day, there was a beautiful conference of some kind going on where food was being sold, and you also had a chance to go into the great big hangar and look at a bunch of aircraft being refurbished. Do you believe that event might take place again this weekend? Mel, go ahead.
No, negative. None of the food business this year. That was part of the Transit Authority operation, which took place today. They have moved it up 1 week from us. A little bit of conflict of interest over the past years, but we were able to straighten that out, but they decide now to move it up 1 week. So I'm afraid we've lost that option. As far as the hangar, the possibility, I think on Sunday we can still go to the hangar and see the additional airplanes, some of the airplanes. The big one that we looked at last year, believe it or not, is gone. The big four-engine C-5 transport flew out of there. I saw it, quite a thing when that went out. So there's still, as Dick saw last year, we were able to look at a lot, actually hands-on for a lot of things, including engines and propellers, and you name it. So it's a fun place to visit. I'm sure Dick really recommend it over.
That I can. When you come back, the Transit Authority had their big conference there. I wonder what was that with reference to? In other words, was it just sort of a an outdoor picnic on a nice, sunny Saturday, Sunday afternoon on a nice, great big field with the possibility of viewing the hangar of the aircraft under refurbishment? Was that the main thing the Transit Authority was doing here, Mel? Go ahead.
Actually, what the main theme of the Transit Authority is called the Bus Rodeo, of all things. And what they do is they show you all kinds of things about buses, alternate fuel buses, how they charge them, and how they repair, how the engines work, at an engine setup. And they had a another demonstration how they, the air conditioning system works in a bus. Oh, on and on and on. All kinds of things, all about buses. No, nothing about trains. This is the bus, the service division of the Transit Authority. So if you're interested in buses, today was the day to have gone and see how a bus is put together. And they have also some futuristic buses, I understand, were supposed to be there. You know, the new buses that are coming through, they are looking into a number of different new bus systems, of course, with, that are going to run on alternate fuels, ones that are being used in Europe that use the method of centrifugal force for propulsion. And there's all kinds of ideas that are batting around, because surely we have to do something about the fuel situation and to get that under control here. You can well imagine that that most likely is one of the problems with the Transit Authority as far as, you know, increasing fares because of the cost of fuel takeover.
Yeah, last week or the week before, you and I and the various people on the TechNet were discussing our energy dependence in the United States and the amount of oil that we import. And there's been quite a few discussions on the news programs this morning on the subject of offshore oil drilling in the Alaska wildlife centers and so on. Should we put up more wind generating stations and solar generating stations and so on? I know the answer is yes. We've got to do something to become less dependent on foreign oil, because that dependency is giving us a strong vulnerability, and we're losing American lives over defending that oil supply. And the trend is kind of obvious that a million people in India, a billion people in India and a couple of billion people in China are now becoming a developing nation that is going to be demanding similar amounts of energy per human being that we are using in the United States. And they're going to be demanding the same oil and coal supplies that we're using. So it's inevitable the price is going to go up. The biofuels, let me drop. The biofuels that we've experimented with, like corn, are not a panacea. We're now using a certain percentage of the corn crop to make a corn ethanol fuel. The good news is that slightly lowers our use of petroleum. The bad news is now the price of food is skyrocketing, because some of the food supply from the farm is being diverted into biodiesel as opposed to food around the world. So everything has a reaction on something else. We have to go to the horse's mouth. All of the real energy is coming from the sun. But by whatever means that we use solar energy directly, whether it be wind, tide, solar voltaic, geothermal, which is not quite solar, but you know what I mean. We've got to start doing that. Yes, it's a long-term investment. Yes, it's going to cost us some money. But the alternative is worse. And even though it's a long-term project, and each administration is reluctant to do it because they're not going to yield the benefit. The benefit's going to happen one or two administrations downrange. So we've got to start somewhere. And so I'd like to believe the voters on the next major election are going to recognize energy issues, because they're tightly related to our economy. If we have the proper source of energy, the economy does good things. Without the proper source of energy, the economy does terrible things. As oil right now at around $130 a barrel goes to like $200 a barrel, and a lot of people think it's going to happen, our economy is going to hurt over it. It's all because of foreign dependence. That may be simplistic, but it's the way I see it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, K2KEY. No doubt that this is going to be possibly one of the situations in this country that we're going to have to deal with soon on an emergency basis. Because you see it already having a wide effect. I just mentioned the food situation. I think that is the most critical part of this problem. Reduction in food. In fact, a number of farmers now have found that producing corn and used to be for, of course, most of it went for, feeding livestock. They found they're reducing their livestock and selling more of the corn for production of ethanol, and they're making a heck of a lot more money. A number of farmers said, well, it's finally beginning to pay off farming. Now, as far as what is happening, you see the airlines now are suffering. They are cut back on flights. They are also putting surcharges of all kinds on the planes. And also we'll see this summer. I'm sure that the price of gasoline, the way it's going up, is going to curtail a lot of traveling people that look for have a seasonal business that depend on, people traveling, going to motels and other things like that, and eating out and all, are going to start to suffer. So there'll be layoffs in that industry. So it's a wide effect. You just look at the prices of your recently in the supermarket, how much just groceries have gone up. So I think we're in for a lot more problems than we are just maybe touching the surface right now, Dick, over.
Yes, we are. And I'd like to believe that the more informed American public are going to see which side of the bread is buttered, so to speak. And energy is a big issue. Energy and fuel and food. The world food supply is suddenly becoming extremely expensive. There's lots of foods that have gone up 130% in a couple of years. So for a developing nation where a high percentage of the people are living at the poverty level or their children are undernourished, we're getting a life and death situation. And if you saw 60 Minutes tonight, you saw this peanut substance that they're making to very inexpensively give a lot of nutrition to starving children in developing nations. Food's a problem, energy's a problem. They're all closely related. And we have to start devoting more of our resources, our technology, to solving that one. This one ain't going to go away. We can't just wait until this one passes over. But with modern drilling technique, I am convinced we can drill in the ANWR, National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, without damaging the terrain and without putting the caribou at very much grief. I know we can do more drilling offshore. I know we can set up more oil refineries. I know we can definitely continue the research into solar voltaics and wind and so on. And to have people say, not in my backyard, and you're not going to build a wind farm 4 miles off the shore of South Long Island is very foolish. We want the energy. I mean, there are lots of communities that say, I don't want you to put any cell phone base stations in my community, but I want to make sure the cell phone works well. Can't have it both ways. I want to make sure I've got reliable energy that's not too expensive. But I don't want you putting up those wind farms. I don't want you putting up those nuclear power stations. You can make those statements, but they're not compatible with each other. You got to look at the bigger picture. We have to make certain sacrifices for the future of our children and of our economy. That's the way I see it. K2KEY and K2LIW.
Roger, I guess. Yes, I guess, I guess say that cliche, not my backyard, is not going to work real well when the lights start going out. The table is boxed with food, because this is one of the real situations now that we have to maybe go to a type of, maybe like a war situation. That we have to do desperate things, or as they say, desperate times call for desperate things. And I think we're approaching that point. And as Dick said, if it could alleviate the use of lots of energy to make electric by putting windmills off 4 miles off the south part of Long Island, I think things like this are just going to have to be said. You know, this has to be done. We have to have it. And drilling off the Atlantic and the Pacific coast has been completely prohibited. And yet, most of all the countries all over the world are of course, doing that. One of the countries that really is, well, let's put it this way, not particularly one of our better friends down south in Venezuela, are making huge fortunes right now. And rubbing it in our eye last year by donating so much amount of oil, surplus oil supposedly, to the poor people, and saying, see, we can do it, and Americans can't. And the point of the matter is that they're doing it with offshore drilling. So there you are. I think we're going to have to really, you know, somebody's got to step up and say, listen, let's stop all this nonsense. We've got to do things right now to alleviate our situation. Otherwise, we're all going to be in so-called sinking boat altogether. But let me let it drop. In some of the interviews, basically, what you see is like an old stupid story or an old stupid cliche, I would say, where a sailor is down in the bottom of the boat and he's punching holes in the bottom of the boat because he's mad at the captain. And we're doing the same thing, you know. It's just not my backyard, but that's what we're doing, basically. We're punching holes in the bottom of our boat and, you know, thinking that, well, it'll affect the next person. I can get it. I can afford it. And but when it's not available, both fuel and food, I think then we're going to wake up. But I think it may be a little too late, Vic. We can't wait for the extreme crisis over.
We really need another person to step forward like a Robert Moses. He gave us those parkways and bridges and whatever. And what was really unusual is that he gave us all of these driving conveniences, and he himself never had a driver's license. But had he lived long enough, we'd have a beautiful bridge across the Long Island Sound going over to Connecticut. And my goodness, is that needed. Every time I visit New England, I have to drive all the way through New York City to the west and then back out to the east. It cost me an extra hour and a half or something like that each way. That wouldn't take place if we had that bridge. You have to make certain sacrifices. You got to look at the bigger picture. And that's what he was doing. I'd love to see, if we had a crystal ball, what is the price of a barrel of oil going to be a year from now? What's the price of a gallon of gasoline going to be a year from now? And will we be standing on gas lines in order to get that fuel? Will we be paying higher premiums to fly? We'll be doing less automobile travel. Right now, Detroit is really hurting when it comes to selling SUVs. People are suddenly getting a lot more gas mileage conscious. A couple of years ago, I thought I wanted a Land Rover automobile until I found out they get 12.5 miles per gallon. Boy, that discouraged me in a hurry. It may be a great vehicle. It has a lot of off-road capability, but I wouldn't be using it anywhere near enough to justify that kind of what sounds like waste. K2KEY, K2RIW. Can we get a lot of emails this week, Mel?
Yeah, I get a number of them. I just say there's a lot of them. I can't really put them out on the air. I will discuss some of these. I'm going to make some notes here and show you some of them. The extraterrestrial ATs and all that, I purposely ignored them. They come in fairly regular, and they've asked a number of these emails why we don't discuss each extraterrestrial type of phenomena. And I purposely have ignored ever bringing them up, Dick, because, well, some of them are a little bit, I think, say, far out. And others, I don't know. I don't know if it's within the realm of the TechNet. If you ever want to go to anything like that, I purposely, like I say, sort of worked around them and never made any comments about it and never really answered, you know, gave any kind of answer, because they range from what seems to be completely, you know, ridiculous, borderline on maybe it's a big joke on that they're trying to put over on us, and the others to extremely serious discussions. In fact, two of them, they, with their proof and everything like that, I'll tell you the truth, I didn't want to get started, Dick, over.
If you get a chance, Ben, bring a couple of those UFO reports, the better-sounding ones, with you next weekend. I'd like to see a couple of those. But I'm not sure it's of general enough interest to really be appropriate for the TechNet. Maybe we'll experiment with one of these days. But I think the first one we ought to choose ought to be an electronic question. And back to you, Mel.
Okay, really, because people would prove that they've made contact and the government cover-ups and that business with that. The flying saucers that have crashed and how they get, and on and on and on, and photographs that were really taken, excellent photographs, and all kinds of things, and how they've been more or less still believe there's a conspiracy going on as far as whether or not we could visit it and whether or not there have been, there is a flying saucer somewhere hidden away somewhere in some special, government warehouse somewhere, and things like that, and proof positive, eyewitness reports, on and on, that a person actually stood there, and he swore to it that he was there, and he saw the bodies being removed from a flying saucer that crashed, and the caskets they were put in, and on and on and on and on, this dick. So that's why I say I don't know which one you'd really want to really get involved with, because I think you're, as they say, getting yourself into something by quicksand. Over.
Let me ask you what I want.
Joe recognized. Yeah, it does sound like a difficult subject to approach. Controversial. But Joe's got the answer to all this. Go ahead, Joe.
No, I don't. I actually have a question for it. It's an electronics question. It's just something completely different from what you're talking about. But it's just something I'm just kind of curious of. And I guess, Dick, you probably have the answer because you've seen that I found the information on this TechNet. What is the highest radio frequency that you know of that man has ever produced as far as a, you know, oscillating frequency? I mean, yeah, you could say the light or infrared, but I mean, those are produced by, you know, certain means. I'm talking about actually from a radio transmitting device. What's the highest that you know of?
Okay, the chief scientist of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, a guy named Jesse Taub, did a fair amount of work at 680 gigahertz. He did that 20 years ago. The Militech company will sell you products that go up to 1,200 gigahertz, which is 1.2 terahertz. And that's getting into close to far infrared. Without a doubt, there's all kinds of laser devices that will make far infrared. When you say radio, you got a little bit of a problem, because DC to light, DC to gamma ray, really is a continuous spectrum. You know what a generator looks like that makes 60 cycles. And you can make a very fancy mechanical one, like the ones they built over there in Denmark, I think it is, that produces signals in the tens of kilohertz and maybe even hundreds of kilohertz. A mechanical machine that makes hundreds of kilohertz connected to an antenna, and it's a very long-range radio transmitter by way of oscillators and tubes and transistors. We can easily get up to high tens of gigahertz and hundreds of gigahertz. You use other techniques when you go any higher than that now. Laser-like technique, but still it's the exact same radio spectrum, even though the antenna looks different, the transmitter looks different, the feed line looks different. So the highest frequency that mankind has constructed is a gamma rays. That's also radio. So we've made far infrared, near infrared, optical, ultraviolet, near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, gamma rays, and so on. So we generated all of that by very... An X-ray machine is a kind of a transmitter. And you can transmit pulses of X-rays if you wanted to and make Morse code out of it. Let me drop. I know what you're asking. By truly radio techniques, techniques you and I would recognize as radio, the ham radio operators are up to 420 gigahertz. And that's a... for the A1... Brian Justin, why can't I think of his call letters right now? It'll come to me in a minute. He's made transmissions, at two-way transmissions at 420 gigahertz. And that's really up there. But a few thousand gigahertz by purely radio techniques have been done. Fancy tubes like carcinotrons and so on. Right now, that denial military device, which gives you a heat wave on your body from a fraction of a mile away, runs at a little bit below 100 gigahertz with a fancy microwave tube. So the hard part in your question really is to decide what is radio and what is quasi-optical far-infrared, because the two regions are starting to overlap. Not yet, but they're about to. Back to you, Joe.
Make a comment on that, Dick.
Yeah, Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, let's talk about the classic. He's looking for what is the classic, what we call radio, what we think of radio spectrum. The radio spectrum, as Dick says, starting down at zero and then going up to 3 kilohertz, which was, of course, called the VLF, the very low frequency systems that you exotic alternators and all kinds of mechanical contrivances to generate that type of radio signal. So the modern version of the radio spectrum is basically considered from 3 kilohertz to 300 gigahertz. When you get above that, you actually, above 300 gig, I'm sure to say that we have to really say we only get to like 1 terahertz up in that point, what is also, say 2.03 centimeters, 3 times 10 to the, the fifth or whatever it is. That is into infrared, and then, of course, right above that is visible light, so when you get into infrared above actually 300 gigs, I think we're actually out of what we think of as classical radio, Dick. Over. Am I correct, over?
Not quite. By classic radio techniques, the Militech company will sell you diode multiplier type devices fed by impact, trap hat, and gun diodes that can produce frequencies around 1.2 or maybe 2.5 terahertz. You would think that that's the beginning of infrared. It's not. The optical frequency, I think, is something like 400 or 750 terahertz. 750 terahertz. There's a great big gap between the upper end of what you and I call radio and the lower end of what the optical people will call far infrared. There's still a huge gap in there. Optical frequency is around 10 to the 15 hertz. A terahertz is only 10 to the 12 hertz. So there's a 1,000-to-1 ratio between the real upper end of radio techniques and the middle of the optical band. And the infrared band is only an octave away from the optical band. So there's still a great big gap in there. And you and I would like to believe that the upper end of radio is the lower end of infrared. We've still got an awful long way to go. One of the things that I used to say on my emails, Joe, is no frequency is high enough. Then E2RYY, just got to think higher frequencies, KQRYW, and SECNET.
Okay, thank you for that answer. You summed it up pretty much as far as what you answered there. 2.5 terahertz, and you're saying it's like 700 terahertz is the beginning of long wave IR field. So, okay. So is that frequency. So now I have a, it just makes you think of how far, man is gone so far. Yes, it's easy to make IR devices and light devices and make things that make X-rays, cosmic rays, and things like that. But I'll talk about, from a practical sense, a circuit that generates an oscillating type of wave that you can do something with. And you said as Dick, I think Mel mentioned up to 3 kilohertz. Isn't the band just above that, like say around 17 or 18 kilohertz used by the Navy to communicate with subs? Someone's around that frequency range. Back to you.
You're absolutely right. It's called a command receiver. And you choose the right super low frequency where you get a kind of resonance between the ionosphere and the Earth. And you can communicate with a submarine at least 60 feet below the surface of seawater anywhere in the world. Part of the antenna system that used to be located in Michigan that did that was called Project Sanguin. And because of satellites now taking over, that system is being abandoned. By the way, I just did a calculation. The middle of the optical band at a yellow-green wavelength is 550 nanometers, 550 times 10 to the minus 9 meters. You and I know that 550 exponential 9 chain time, and 3 times 10 to the 8 is the speed of light, 3 exponential 8. Divide one into the other, which I'm about to do. There we go. And so the middle of the optical band is 5 times 10 to the 14 hertz. So 545 terahertz is the middle of the optical band. And as of That's a long way, 545,000 gigahertz. And mankind, by radio technique, has only gone to 1 or 2 gigahertz. You can see there's a pretty big gap in there yet. So we got a ways to go. But by way of some of the emails, we're gonna get there. Dream on. Back to you, Mel, and maybe you ought to get to the first email letter. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Actually, the FCC is really recognizing now that the radio spectrum is 3 kilohertz to 300 kilohertz as the reference of what we call our radio spectrum. However, that's it. Above 300, the charts really now, I saw one of the charts recently, they call it that, starting at right up above 300, they're calling it the infrared band. Actually, they consider, of course, visible light, let's say what hertz, easy, I think everybody to associate what we're talking about by hertz. Visible light, I believe, is what, 10 to the 14th hertz to 10 to 15 hertz, whereas the infrared is actually starts at somewhere around, what, 1 terahertz and goes to 10 to the 14th. In other words, it's sandwiched in between, say, 300 gigahertz and visible light, that infrared is somewhere in there between 300 gigahertz and 10 to the 14th. Hertz, where we saw visible light. Is that a correct assumption? Over.
Okay, the middle of optical light is 5 times 10 to the 14. That's 550 nanometers, happens to be 5.45, 10 to the 14 hertz. That's the middle of the optical band. And the infrared band is only an octave below that, half that frequency, one quarter of that frequency. You may have read some literature, Mel, which says above 300 gigahertz is infrared. They may have said that. In my opinion, it is inaccurate. When I first got into ham radio, and you looked at the spectrum charts by the FCC, the chart used to stop at 10,000 megacycles. I think they called it 10 kilomegacycles. 10,000 kilomegacycles, that's what they used to call it. It really was 10 gigahertz. They used to say, no license required, all above 10 gigahertz. They didn't use the word gigahertz then, but you know what I mean. A little bit later, they said all above 30 gigahertz was unlicensed. No definition. Nowadays, for quite a period of time, all above 300 gigahertz is unlicensed and undefined. That's going to change. It's going to be all above 3 terahertz is going to be undefined. So, people may call it infrared. I don't think a real, true optical engineer would call it that. Optical engineers talk about 10 microns as a wavelength, a so-called eye-safe material. And that's 550 nanometers is really 0.5 microns. 0.55 microns is the middle of the optical band. And the low end of real infrared maximum usage is around 10 microns. So that's 20 times lower in frequency. You've still got a long way to go between there and a terahertz. I'll work out what frequency is 10 microns, but to me, anything lower in frequency than a wavelength of 10 microns is almost out of the far infrared region and getting into that gray zone in between the upper end of radio and the lower end of optical. There's still a lot of decades of essentially undefined frequency in there. We got a long way to go. One of my dreams is to someday listen to a laser at a quasi-optical frequency beat down into a single sideband receiver so you can hear the tone of Doppler shift when you move the laser. I'd love to be able to hear that. Stand by. Airborne Instruments Laboratory that I used to work for used to manufacture a device called a laser interferometer. It used a helium neon red laser, and it literally counted cycles as you moved out away from a corner cube, and it would do very precise calibration of a lathe bed, for instance. equipment, your distance measuring equipment on a lathe bed. And when they used to make those measurements in a building, where sometimes you have a very long lathe bed that was manufacturing spars and wings of big airplanes and things like that, that laser interferometer would go haywire if you opened the door in the room and a blast of air came along, and the air was a little bit colder or warmer than the air in the room. The propagation constant of the air would change. If a railroad train went by outside of the building a quarter of a mile away, you could see the bending of the building by way of the laser interferometer because of the weight of the train bending the earth a little bit as it went by. I'd love to be able to hear those effects on a single sideband receiver. Someday I may get there. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Well, right now, as I just was saying, that you feel that above 300 gigs, that it continues on radio as we call the radio spectrum. But I believe there is no necessity for getting a license on anything above 300 gigs. Right now, up to 300 gigs, I believe you need a FCC license or something. But, of course, right somewhere up in that neighborhood, up just below 300 gigs, I believe it's is that part of the radio astronomy thing that they have down, you know, in that quiet zone, that the radio astronomy and system that they keep there is got where is that the frequency that they're using some of it around somewhere up around 250 or 275 gigs? Is that correct, Dick? Over.
Well, without a doubt, some radio astronomy has been done there, Mel. When you look at the great big frequency spectrum, and you go to an FCC site, I'll someday find that email address again, and you can print out this huge colored chart which shows you what's assigned to every frequency. When it comes to frequencies set aside for quiet zones for radio astronomy, there's one of those almost every octave all the way up the band. It's all over the place. Set aside frequencies, 60 gigahertz is one of them. We have a whole lot of individual resonance lines for oxygen. And so it's hard to say what frequency has been set aside for radio astronomy. A whole zillion bunch of frequencies have been set aside, essentially every octave. Sometimes they get violated, but that's another whole story. Are there specifically assigned frequencies set aside for any particular service above 300 gigahertz? To my knowledge, the answer is no, but I recommend that. I predict that that's going to rapidly change because the techniques for generating frequencies up there are getting more and more prevalent, and people are starting to make use of it. One of the highest frequencies I worked on was 176 gigahertz, and there was a transistor that gave gain at that frequency, but my goodness, was it small and delicate. Wow. You breathed on it and you killed it, almost literally, because you created a static charge it couldn't tolerate. And that was going to go into a very fancy satellite that the company I was working for was involved in at the time. So, no frequency is high enough. We're always going to be moving up. Let me drop. No matter whatever frequency we're at, we think frequencies above that are going to be only line of sight, short range, and relatively useless. That's how the hams got everything above 200 meters. Everything below 200 meters, above 1.5 megacycles, those frequencies were considered useless. And we've been through that scenario a whole lot of times in a row, where the next decade of frequencies up, you're allowed to do anything you want with it. And so there was a period of time with anything above 3 megacycles, you could do anything you want, anything above 30 megacycles, anything above 100 megacycles. And when I first got into ham radio, it was undefined above 10 gigs and then undefined above 30 gigs. Now it sounds like it's temporarily undefined above 300 gigs, but I guarantee that's going to change pretty fast because people are building circuits that work up there. Militech is one of many companies. Hughes was also involved in quite a few of those things at one time. K2KEY. Better read one of those emails now. K2RAW.
Okay, this is KEY. Very, very interesting to say. really looking at the FCC's right now criteria for the radio spectrum. So we'll, I guess, see what the future is, and no doubt maybe be communicating via some exotic light systems up in the infrared zone. And whether or not maybe there is our communications of the future lying possibly way above 300 gigs. Anyhow, all right, let's see. Let me look around here. Okay, there seems to be some confusion. In fact, there seems to be a lot of confusion. We discussed last week, I think we got into a little bit of detail about, again, I'm going to tell you about what's going on the HF band, being that we're talking about radio spectrum. Let's go back down towards, way, way down from 300 gigs. Let's go down to 10 megahertz, known as the 30-meter band. Again, it was very spectacular this week, whereas I was listening to 20 and absolutely completely dead because almost no noise level. 40 was so-so. 80 meters was extremely noisy because of a lot of local activity there as far as storms go, causing, you know, constant big naps. And, yeah, wearing headphones sometimes, it feels like it's coming right through you. Now, the 10 gig, the 30-meter band, again, had its openings that were unbelievable to the Pacific area, way Australia, New Zealand, the islands. Europe was pouring in to the point where, for some reason, there was very little activity over the United States here, and I became sort of a pile-up. I had a number of European stations, one after another, calling me. And I'm using, again, a modest antenna for 30 meters. Let me let it drop. Okay. And the way I describe the antenna is where I've got the emails. We talked about this sort of loper, but I think because we explained it wrong, Dick, the way the confusion came in. So I thought maybe I could we could clarify that, because I've got at least seven emails just asking me about 30 meters and the type of antenna that seems to perform right. So if you'd like, we could dwell on that for a few minutes. Over.
Yes, I think we should, Mel. When it comes to your sloper that was being defined last week, I think there was some confusion as to the definition of the angles involved. And I was going to bring a piece of paper and a protractor, and I was going to draw some of those angles for you this coming weekend, because I think there was some confusion. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, the confusion is, here's where the confusion is. We kept saying, you know, to envision a triangle where the tree would be the vertical element of it, that the base would be the ground, and that the hypotenuse is the antenna. But I should have said, and I think this is where the confusion came, that the hypotenuse is not a straight line drawn from the point where it's hung to the tree down. It drops, it droops down almost close to vertical from the tree, because of the way my feed line is and the way I just let it droop, because I've got to have a lot of, you know, give, because otherwise, if the antenna gets into an argument with the tree during a windstorm, you know which one is going to win. So what I do is it's fairly loose. So what happens is that part of it, the part that drops down from the tree, is coming down very close to the vertical, and then it curves off and makes approximately a 28-degree now angle at that point. So I think what the confusion was, Dick, basically I should have said it looked like a concave type of antenna, like a parabolic, over.
Yeah, technically, if your wire has the same weight per length, if it's a constant diameter wire, that curve is called a catenary. A slightly more vertical version of what you've got on a suspension bridge, the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, that wire that looks somewhat parabolic that goes between the vertical stands, that is a catenary, and there's a version of that catenary, a piece of that catenary is what you've got from the tree. And I was trying to pin down the angle that it makes with reference to the ground, or with reference to a perpendicular to the ground at the lower end. And I think there was some confusion there. Even though it's a catenary, when you talked about the 28 degrees, I wasn't sure with the wire with the curve, where it got close to the ground, was it 28 degrees away from parallel, or 28 degrees away from a perpendicular line to the ground. How about you, Mel?
Yeah, basically, it's hard to describe it, but if you let it just droop down, it comes very close. In other words, it makes that curve down on the bottom to a fairly small angle. In other words, because it loops the antenna, it's a sloper. You know, they're envisioning basically a sloper antenna that may be tied to a tower. And because the tower is pretty well a fixed, you know, object that doesn't move very much, and then they pull the wire, the sloping wire, very tight down to a support, a ground support, so that the wire is classically, as you would draw a triangle, being the tower would be one leg, the ground another leg, and then the hypotenuse or the antenna would be more or less straight. But this is not the case. I think this is where we confused a lot of people, that I should have said that it would be dropping down almost vertically and then curving off just by the situation there, because you do have to leave a lot of leeway with a tree that's 70 feet, 65, 70 feet tall, a spruce tree, and that really moves around in the wind, because you remember, that thing has always got its so-called, what you want to call, leaves on it. So it can really move, but they're very strong. They're very strong trees, but they move quite a bit in the wind pitch. So you will have to leave a heck of a lot of leeway with a tree like that with your antenna wire, because otherwise it'll snap like, quickly just break like it was never there over.
Yeah, I think various guys have set up pulleys and weights and springs and other things to have enough compliance to allow the tree to sway without breaking the antenna. I've set up dipoles that go from my tower to trees, and no matter how many springs I put on the end, it's only a short period of time, it's about 3/4 of a year, when a big enough wind comes along and the spring gets broken. I've had that happen over and over again. So I've never really solved the problem of properly suspending a inverted D dipole from my tower over to the trees. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, that was one of the questions that came up. If you put up a dipole, I've had this a number of questions, and I don't know if we've covered it, and I think that many times you may have covered it, that a dipole does not have to look like classically, I can draw it in a book, you know, pulled between two points, that a dipole could be kind of wishy-washy. It could be almost like a big W or whatever, with a lot of droops up and down from support, and it will work perfectly well, that the droop will not really have any kind of negative effect on the operation of the dipole. So I think we should clarify that it doesn't necessarily have to be tight, the wire. Now, how much can you tolerate before, you know, changing the characteristics from whatever? If you get into a shape of a parabolic, or like you say, a catenary type of shape, can we still say it is a dipole, or are we going to call it some kind of a different type of antenna thing? Over.
Yeah, this is an area of quite a bit of misunderstanding. I've done some experimenting on this at VHF frequencies, and I'm pretty sure what I found on VHF is going to be very similar on HF. The classic book will show you a dipole as being completely flat, parallel to the ground for a horizontal dipole, completely flat out. And with any reasonable droop of wire without a zillion pounds of tension on it, you're never going to get an antenna like that. And you don't need that. If the center support is a tower or a tree, and the wires droop down a whole lot on each side, that's called an inverted V dipole. And if you droop it down such that you get the 28 degree magic angle that you found out, you're going to have a very good dipole. That's a lot of droop. As you take the two ends of a dipole and start off straight out, and you start bringing the two ends closer and closer together by swinging them about an arc, where you're swinging them like a compass, and the pivot point is the center insulator of the dipole, and you're swinging those two points together. Your first question is, what happens? And that, as you start drooping them from some reasonable altitude at the center, the normal null that you get off the end disappears. You now have a sloper dipole off the end, and it's still a very good dipole when you look at it broadside. As you bring those ends closer and closer together, your radiation resistance does decrease. Your radiation resistance for a flat-out dipole starts off at around 73 ohms. As you bring it down to, I'm going to say, close to a 90-degree angle at the center insulator, the two wires are 90 degrees apart. So you could say the right-hand wire is sloping down 45 degrees, the left-hand wire is sloping down 45 degrees. When you do that, your radiation resistance will drop to something in the vicinity of 50 ohms or so. So your radiation resistance drops, but it still works like a charm. And a 50-ohm dipole, an inverted D dipole, could be a beautiful dipole, as long as you have a reasonable balun on it. And that balun, let me drop, can be either be a commercially made device, like the Unideller or the W2AD or whatever it is, a balun, or you could also make a poor man's balun by a few turns of the coax cable taped together at that area. As you bring the ends of the dipole closer together yet, the radiation resistance drops even more. The limiting case is when you bring the two ends together so that they are at the same separation as the center insulator. You've now made a purely vertical-looking dipole-like thing, but really it's a pair of twin lead wires. You do that, your radiation resistance now drops to almost 0 ohms, because what you think is an antenna is now a piece of transmission line. It's a twin lead transmission line. And it's a quarter wavelength of length, it's got an open circuit at the far end, therefore you will sense a near 0 ohms at the input end, and very little radiation will take place. So the limiting case is when you bring the two ends together at the same spacing as the center insulator, you've now made twin leads. I think if the center angle is much below, I'm going to pick a number, I know that a 90 degree center angle gives you around 50 ohms of radiation resistance. And you may have to adjust the length a little bit to get it back into resonance, because as you bring the ends down, the ends have a little bit more capacitance to the ground or nearby trees or whatever, and the antenna starts moving down a little bit in frequency. You might have to shorten it slightly. But by sweeping it across the band of interest and plotting the standing wave ratio, you'll see that classic bathtub curve, and you'll rapidly find out if the metal of the bathtub is at your favorite frequency. And you know which way to shorten it or lengthen it to move it up or down in frequency. So the limiting case is when the wires are parallel, 90 degrees is a beautiful place to be. 180 degrees is where you start. 90 degrees is a beautiful place to be. I think when you get down to about 30 degrees of center angle, now you're getting an antenna that's pretty hard to use. I wouldn't go there. I wouldn't go a hell of a lot beyond the 90 degree point. Maybe 75 degrees. I wouldn't go much beyond that, because now your radiation resistance is getting into the 20 and 30 ohm category, and without some kind of a impedance matching device, you're starting to develop a fairly high standing wave ratio, and your transmitter is going to be unhappy. So once you view it as a kind of twin lead transmission line, which as a inverted V is a beautiful radiator in almost all directions, by the way, you would think it would favor the radiation down the center toward the ground. Well, it doesn't do that. It radiates essentially in all directions. So up to the point of making it a twin lead, you still have an antenna. And I've gone pretty close to that point. I've gone pretty close to that point for a particular experiment I was doing once at a VHF frequency. So maybe this helps. I don't think any of the books cover this subject. I haven't seen this subject covered in the antenna book, the antenna engineering handbook, the radio amateur handbook. I've heard them vaguely mention inverted V's.